This morning, let's get right into it. If you would turn to the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. Book of Hebrews, chapter 11. Launching a brand new series today. Let's give some context, some background, and we'll get to the launching of the series in just a moment. For the next several weeks, we're going to talk about faith. I'm not going to spend a lot of time throwing out definitions of faith. We're going to explore faith as demonstrated through the life of a character in the Bible. We will get to that character in a moment. What I will say about faith, particularly as it is described in the letter to the Hebrews, is that it's an item that the Hebrew writer will say it plays a vital role in the life of a follower of Christ. And we'll read that in just a second. And it goes further, the Hebrew writer, and particularly in chapter 11 of Hebrews. The writer gives a description, definition of faith. But more than that, the writer describes faith through the actions and activities of many characters in chapter 11. Hence, chapter 11 has often been called or nicknamed the chapter about the heroes of faith. So let's take a look at the first few verses in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 1 through 3. It says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction," some of your versions may say evidence, "the conviction of things not seen. Indeed, by faith, our ancestors received approval. By faith, we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was made from things that are not visible." The Hebrew writer describes faith as the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence or the conviction of things not seen, the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Then he goes on to say, by faith, our ancestors received approval. Our ancestors, our spiritual ancestors. That is an incredible setup for a chapter that will describe faith by introducing ancestors. The audience minds are taken to the rich spiritual history that they all share. It includes a wealth of names and characters. If you keep reading, you'll see that the writer starts to name drop. He starts to list some of these ancestors' names, these spiritual ancestors, and describe how that ancestor displayed their faith and gained approval by God. So if you keep reading in Hebrews chapter 11, verse number 4, it says, "By faith, Abel," or Havel, "offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain. Through this, he received approval as righteous, God himself giving approval to his gifts. He died, but through his faith, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken so that he did not experience death, and he was not found because God had taken him. For it was attested before he was taken away that he had pleased God." So again, the writer begins to name drop. Abel, he offered a better sacrifice by faith. Enoch, he pleased God. He didn't experience death because of his faith. Then there's Hebrews chapter 11 and verse number 6. This is where the writer describes how faith is such an important piece of a follower of Jesus. Hebrews chapter 11, verse number 6. "And without faith, it is impossible to please God. For whoever would approach him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him." Without faith, it is impossible to please God. Then after that, the Hebrew writer begins to mention more names. And you may recognize, if you're Bible students from the Old Testament, you know, by faith, Abraham. He talks a lot about Abraham. And by faith, Isaac. And by faith, Jacob. And by faith, David. And some other characters. Now, I skipped over a name after the Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, because verse number 22 mentions this name. Verse number 22 of Hebrews 11, by faith, Joseph. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. His bones. That's kind of odd. It's kind of strange. Why his bones? Some translation says his burial. By faith, he gave instructions about his burial. I get, you know, by faith Noah built an ark, and I get by faith Abraham, you know, offered his. I get, but by faith Joseph gave instructions about his burial and his bones. What does that mean? What are we to learn regarding the importance of Joseph's bones and how it connects to faith? Well, we will discover through the exploration of the Joseph story what that means. The best way to try to figure out the importance of Joseph's bones is to look at the story of Joseph. So that's what we're going to do for the next several weeks. We're going to look at Joseph. We're going to look at him talking about bones at one point. We're going to talk about this roller coaster ride of life that Joseph had and the faith that he had through this roller coaster life. And what we will see is that Joseph had a faith that came in many colors, a faith in many, many colors. That's the series we're going to park in for the next several weeks, remainder of September, and most of October. And thus, we begin this journey into the saga of Joseph. It is a saga. It's a long story. Joseph's biography is one that definitely deserves attention. This character in the Old Testament, you don't hear him connected when they mention the great patriarchs, when they say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They stop at Jacob. But Joseph certainly was one of the patriarchs, the son of Jacob. And Joseph's story takes up a significant portion of Genesis, from chapters 37 all the way to the end of Genesis in chapter 50. The patriarchs are those that those who descended from them always look back to. Their stories inform their faith and inform their journey. And so it's important for us to go back from time to time to look at these patriarchs. So we're gonna focus on Joseph. To briefly describe Joseph, he was the 11th son of a man by the name of Jacob, who would later be known as Israel. But a brief description of Joseph leaves so much off the table. So this morning, I want to introduce you to Joseph by telling you about his family and his family tree, his family history. And when it comes to Joseph's family, there is one word that describes his family: dysfunctional. There's no other way to put it. This family was dysfunctional. In fact, dysfunctional might be too kind of a word to describe the family of Joseph. Yet, it's fitting as we explore the faith of Joseph as we set this series up. The dysfunction in Joseph's immediate family, his siblings, which that's what we're going to explore going forward, is rooted in the family history of those who came before him. The book of Genesis records the history of the first families on earth. And from the very beginning, there was dysfunction. I'll be the first to tell you that if you go to the book of Genesis in an effort to go and try to find the perfect family, you're probably not going to find it. After Adam and Eve were created, perhaps that's as perfect as it gets, but after the sin came into the world, you're going to be hard-pressed to try to find a model family in the book of Genesis. Adam and Eve had two sons, Cain and Abel. Cain was upset with his brother Abel, and he killed him. The very first sibling rivalry. Anyone here know about sibling rivalry? Any of you grew up with your brothers and sisters, and you've got this thing going on with your sisters and brothers? I see some of you parents looking at some of your kids. Some of you looking at some of your kids, but some of you are looking in your own hearts, and you're like, yeah, I grew up with a brother or a sister that, you know, we were just always at each other's throats, always competing, always trying to get more attention from our parents. I want you to know, sibling rivalry, one of the major themes in the book of Genesis. It starts with Cain and Abel. So get used to sibling rivalry showing up. Even as I describe this family history of Joseph, you'll see a sibling rivalry over and over again. Moving down in Joseph's ancestral line, we come to a man named Abram. His name was later changed to Abraham, which means father of many. Abraham was called by God to follow him. God promised him to make him into a great nation. And Abraham knew that this meant that he, God would bless him with children. The only problem was that his wife Sarai, begin with, it was changed to Sarah. The only problem was that Sarai couldn't have children. And so that presented a problem. So Abram and Sarai decided to get into the mix and help God out with what God said. And so Sarai said, look, you take Hagar, my maidservant, and go have a child with her. Get used to that. That happens a lot in Genesis, y'all. And so then Hagar goes, and she has a child by the name of Ishmael. And Ishmael and Hagar are hated by Sarai, and they treat Hagar and Sarah, and they run them off, and you start seeing this family dysfunction. Later on, you'll note that Abram he's taking care of his nephew Lot, because Abram's older brother died, and part of the rules back then is that you take care of your brother's family if he dies. And so Abram raises Lot as his son, probably more like his brother. And what you'll learn later on in Genesis is that they begin fighting with each other. Sibling rivalry, family rivalry. Within Abraham has a child, the true child that he was supposed to have, by the name of Isaac. And Isaac has this really beautiful love story with this woman named Rebecca, and that was kind of cool. Then they have kids, and they have twin boys. They have twin boys, one named Esau, which means red. He was real hairy when he was born. And then they had the younger twin, the one that came out afterward. They named him Jacob, which means heel grabber. Why did they name him heel grabber? Because that's literally what he did when he came out the womb. He was grabbing on the heel of Esau as if to say, I want to go first. But he didn't go first, and Esau went first. And trust me, that would be a precursor to a whole life of wanting to be first and not last. And Esau and Jacob, they were constantly at each other's throats. Jacob was a liar. I mean, there's no other way to describe him. He was a liar. He deceived his brother once, tricking him, giving him some food so that he could get his birthright. You see, the birthright goes to the oldest son and not the youngest son. And so he tricked Esau out of his birthright. And then as their father Isaac was about to die, Isaac is about to bless the older son. And the mother, Rebecca, gets with Jacob and says, hey, let's trick daddy. I'm going to put a whole bunch of hair on you. See, your daddy's blind. And so, you know, he's going to touch, and he'll touch and think that you're Esau, and he'll bless you instead of blessing Esau. And so that's exactly what they did. They lied to Isaac, and Isaac blessed Jacob, and Esau found out, and Esau says, you know what, as sure as I'm living, I'm going to take you out, bro. Sibling rivalry. Well, Jacob runs, and he escapes Esau's threats. And his mother, Rebecca, told Jacob, hey, I want you to go to my brother's house. And he goes to her brother's house. Her brother's name was Laban. And so he gets to Laban's house, and I'm here. And while he's at a well, he sees this woman there. And Jacob says, oh my goodness, she is hot. Beautiful. The word says beautiful, but hot, beautiful. She's good looking. She's gorgeous. It was Laban's daughter. Okay, let me just get real. It was Jacob's cousin. Okay, church, get used to it. It just happens a lot in Genesis. Cousins, all that stuff. But anyway, he goes to Laban and he says, hey, Unc, can I have Rachel as my wife? And Laban says, I tell you what, work for me 7 years. You work for me 7 years and you can have Rachel as your wife. Man, she must have been really beautiful because Jacob said, I'll do it. So Jacob works 7 years, and then comes the night of his wedding. They give him some drink, and he had a lot of drink. And so he goes to bed with a lot of drink in him. And Laban says, all right, here's your wife. Have fun. Yeah. And then they wake up in the morning, and he turns over to look at Rachel, except it's not Rachel. It's Leah. Laban lied to the liar and gave her the order. So Jacob goes, what are you doing? I asked for Rachel, saying, I didn't ask for Leah. Then Laban says, oh, you know, it's custom that the older daughter has to get married before the younger daughter. I'm sorry. But I wanted Rachel. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you Rachel too. But you got to work for me another 7 years. Jacob says, I'll do it. Again, Rachel must have been incredibly beautiful. So he works another 7 years, and finally, he's married. And so he's married to sisters. And we see from very early on that Rachel and Leah don't like each other. Sibling rivalry. Remember I told you we're going to keep coming back to sibling rivalry? So the text uses some very interesting language to describe both Leah and Rachel. For Leah, the Bible says, she had tender eyes. That's all it says. It says Leah had tender eyes. Then it says, but Rachel was beautiful. So you have to, you know, make a determination on what that means for yourself. Leah's got tender eyes. Rachel is beautiful. I think tender eyes is a way of saying that she wasn't that pretty. But Jacob gave more of his attention to Rachel because she was more beautiful. God saw how Leah was being mistreated, and the text says that God opened her womb. If I can be blunt here, Leah was a baby-making machine. She started having babies. Rachel couldn't have babies. She was barren. But Leah started having babies. She had her first child. His name was Reuben. Then she had a second child. His name was Simeon. Then she had a third child. His name was Levi. Then she had a fourth child. His name was Judah. Well, Rachel's watching this because women back then, like, they didn't want diamonds. They didn't want gold. You know what they wanted? They wanted sons. They wanted children. And Rachel wanted children, but she couldn't have any, and it really pained her heart. So she went to Jacob with an idea. She said, look, my father gave me a maidservant by the name of Bilhah. You know what? You can have her as your wife, and I want you to make children with her. And Jacob said, okay. So Jacob and Bilhah get together, and they have two kids, Dan and Naphtali. Well, Leah, even though she was a baby-making machine and had babies, she said, well, Dad gave me a maidservant too. Her name was Zilpah. And so Leah goes to Jacob and says, hey, I want to give you my maidservant Zilpah, and I want you to make children with her. And Jacob said, okay. And so they have babies, and they named them Gad and Asher. But Leah wasn't finished making babies yet, and she had two more babies named Issachar and Zebulun. Then finally, after all the groaning that Rachel had given for not having children, she finally, God blessed her, opened her womb, and she had a baby. It would have been the 11th son of Jacob, and his name was Joseph. Later on, as they are traveling to another homeland, Rachel was pregnant again, and she got pregnant with her second son. And it was a painful childbirth, and she actually died after delivering as soon as she gave her youngest son his name, Benjamin. That was the 12th son. She died. Oh, by the way, Leah had another kid. She had a daughter named Dinah. Again, baby-making machine. And so there you have it. The 13 children of Jacob, namely these 12 sons. We have nicknamed them, called them the 12 sons of Israel. 12 would become the 12 tribes of Israel. Jacob had two wives and two kind of wives, 13 children. He was a deceiving, lying father. Church, dysfunctional. And with all that background, we turn to the rest of Genesis, which will focus on the story of Joseph. And Joseph's saga was introduced in this way. This is Genesis chapter 37, verse number 1 from the New American Standard. It says, "Now Jacob lived in a land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. And there are these are the records of the generation of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pastoring the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms." Sibling rivalry. Started with Cain and Abel, and here we have it in the final narrative in Genesis. Sibling rivalry. They hated him and couldn't even speak to him. Not only are you going back and tattletelling, but Dad done given you this expensive, multicolored coat, which was probably a way of saying that when comes time for me to pass on and bless, which normally goes to the oldest, you know who I'm going to bless and give my inheritance to? You, Joseph. That last statement might hold the key to the rest of the story, and we're going to dive deeply into that story over the next several weeks. But for now, as we draw to a close, let's consider this idea of dysfunction that has seemed to grab a stranglehold of this family and its family's history and development. Let's be honest. Many of us, while not as chaotic, have our own family histories to contend with. Our family histories are less than perfect. They're less than picturesque families we are prone to hype up as ideal. We're not the Huxtables. We're not the Cleavers. We're not the Waltons or the Partridge family. No. We have some serious dysfunction and issues that mess with the mind and the heart. Here's the spoiler alert. We are in this place worshiping God in the name of Jesus because of this dysfunctional family. Dysfunction has never been a deterrent to the work of God. And if ever there was a clear message that God works through dysfunction, it will be highlighted in the saga of Joseph. But that truth in and of itself may not be enough to bring healing to those of us who have struggled with family dysfunction. I was just watching a video the other day of a gospel artist, Kirk Franklin. If you go to YouTube, I don't know if I did see Nick, but tell Nick to go watch this video on YouTube. There's a link. Take a picture of that and go look that up, or just go to YouTube and Google Kirk Franklin story and go watch this 35-minute video. A touching story of Kirk Franklin, who is probably the most successful gospel artist, 19 Grammys. He's sold millions and millions of records. He's working on a new record right now. which is the source of this short documentary. The story is this, that Kirk was adopted. He knew who his birth mother was, but knew that he couldn't live with her, and just for years he just felt rejected. And those of you who know those who experience adoption, some of them, not all, but some do feel this feeling of rejection. It's not that they don't love their adoptive parents. It's not that they don't do well in their adoptive families, but there's always that sense of, why doesn't my mama want me? Especially when you get to see your birth mom and you can't go with your birth mom, like you have a visit, but then you can't leave with her. You feel like, what have I done wrong? And so you start thinking that there's something wrong with me. In the documentary, at one point, he says, man, I would give all the trophies back to just be known by my real parents. Well, he came to find out that the person who might have been his father, they discovered his identity. And in 2017, he went to this guy that he was told was his father to make peace with him because he was dying of cancer. It didn't go all that well, but at least he met his real father. And then earlier this year, at a funeral, there was a guy at the funeral that said something like, hey, I dated Kirk Franklin's mother. And then rumors started to swirl. Man, Kirk Franklin kind of looks like that guy. Kirk Franklin kind of sounds like that guy. That guy might be Kirk Franklin's father. So making a long story short, don't want to completely spoil the whole video, they get a DNA test, find out that this guy is his father, 99.99999%. So what he discovered is not only that was his father, but his mother, who had been historically deceitful to him, lied to him yet about something else. And so the documentary is him dealing with this new revelation. And what comes out in the documentary is that the lack of the relationship he had with his father informed the bad relationship he had with his own son. Do you see how sometimes dysfunction bears more dysfunction, and more dysfunction bears more dysfunction? Some of our families are gripped with this. This might not be as popular, salacious, or infamous as a Kirk Franklin story, but earlier this year, I'm doing some DNA research, and I come to find out that, you know, I thought I had X number of aunts and uncles. I found out that I had an additional aunt that no one knew about. Come to find out that this woman had been searching for her birth family for years. She's 70 years, turned 70 years. She's been looking for nearly 60-some years for her real family. And because of Ancestry.com, show that next picture. Is that up there? If you're looking, you know, there's a woman in the stripe. That's my Aunt Linda, the woman with the Mickey Mouse. That's my mommy. And next to her is her sister Jean. And next to her is my Aunt Sonia, who we didn't know existed. Next to her is my Aunt Cheryl. And in the front is my Uncle Melvin. What's interesting is that Aunt Sonia was put up for adoption in 1950. But the younger sister, who's to her right, she wasn't put up for adoption. So we're all asking these questions like, why did they put her up for adoption? Like, what's going on? And guess what? We will never know the answers because everyone who was involved, they're dead. But there's questions. And even as you see these smiles, beneath some of these smiles is some inner turmoil. There's some hurt. But here's the good news. There's still some reconciliation to be done. Show that next pic. The joy that I saw when I met my aunt and the tears that came up in her eyes when she looked at me and said, I see people my own age that I look like. I've never experienced that. My kids look like me. My grandkids look like me, but no one that's like in my age range look like me, and I'm so overjoyed. And for whatever reason, that joy is beginning to overtake some of the turmoil and some of the questions. There's some dysfunction in my family. My mother's father left the family when they were kids. never to be seen again. We have no clue what happened. And there's some resentment there. But the good news is that many of my aunts and uncles can testify that through it all, God has been present. I want you to get used to the statement that you'll see throughout the story of Joseph. The Lord was with Joseph. The Lord was with Joseph. With all the dysfunction, with all the temptation, with all the nightmares, with all the deception, with all that went on throughout the saga of Joseph, we'll see God keep emerging. The Lord was with Joseph. Emerging out of the sordid history of Joseph and his dysfunctional family is God's providence and God's deliverance. Get used to hearing the Lord was with Joseph. For us in our own family struggles, or struggles dealing with dark seasons, it will be a great comfort to see the Lord's hand in our lives despite the nightmares, the temptations, or the dysfunction. Since the beginning of time, the Lord's presence has invoked a kind of still. Here's Israel at the brink of the Red Sea, about to be devoured by the Egyptian army. Moses says, be still. The Lord's got this. Here's Israel on the brink of going into the promised land, about to fight these mighty armies to take possession of the land. Be still. The Lord's got this. Throughout the history of our lives as the people of God, we've been inundated with dark seasons, nightmares, diagnoses. It's dark. It's heavy. And there's God saying, just be still. I've got this. So many of us will have our own testimony that even in the darkest, deepest valley and pit, the Lord was with me. But he didn't cure your cancer. The Lord was with me. But you lost your only child. The Lord was with me. Our call is to be still. We're going to read a story of Joseph who had every reason to give up, throw his hands up, say, I'm done. But he invoked within his life a stillness, a resilience. It's one of the reasons that we keep going back and reading that story to get encouragement in our own dark seasons, in our own dysfunctional families, in our own chaotic marriages and relationships with our children. Be still. The Lord is with us. We're going to sing a song that speaks to that. I pray that this song speaks right into your situation. That when these oceans come and begin to shake your very foundation, that God will speak to you to be still. If there's a situation right now that's got you rattled, it's got you shaken, it's got you in a state of total dysfunction, I want you to allow us to surround you and pray over you for God to calm the waters. Or maybe the waters keep shaking and God calms you. Let's stand. Let's sing.